Hello, I'm Andy Riga. This is number 0113, the Stockpile Program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed once again the Stuff File Program, number 0113. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, Mark Abrams is back to talk about the 2011 edition of the Ig Nobel Prizes. Are the Ig Nobels getting more respect as time goes on?
There's, I think, a different kind of respect that goes to this than goes to other things. On important things like the Nobel Prizes, there's the obvious kind of respect. Somebody has done something that's clearly wonderful. It makes the world a better place. With us, the Ig Nobels are for things that make people laugh and then think. Could be good, could be bad, doesn't matter. Could be important, could be completely unimportant, also doesn't matter. But the fact is that if somebody decides to accept a prize, they've not only done something that makes people laugh and then think, but they're willing to get up in public and talk about it and sort of celebrate the unusualness.
Sharon Lynn Wyeth is the author of Know the Name, Know the Person, Letters Reveal Secrets. She has developed Nameology. How did that come about?
My brain started picking up patterns in people's names as I was a school teacher making seating charts. So when I had a bunch of unknown students at the beginning of the year, my brain started telling me about these children. And I was curious enough to write down what the brain said about all of it and then get to know the kids and look at it 3 months later. I was absolutely amazed. I mean, my Joshuas were brilliant and obnoxious. My Rachels were pretty. My Dianes could sit anywhere and get along with anybody. My Derricks needed extra time and attention. I mean, I was just amazed at what my brain had said about certain names.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, coming to you from the balcony. On this edition of Book Banter, I'll take a sneak preview of Roger Ebert's memoir, Life Itself, along with some other movie reviews type books that will get two thumbs up from me, and that's coming soon. Stuff File Program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0113, was Andy Riga, the city blogger and transportation reporter for the Montreal Gazette. You can find his fine articles both in the Dead Tree version and, of course, online. Check the MontrealGazette.com and you'll find information. You could also follow Andy Riga, and Riga is spelled R-I-G-A, on Twitter. And thank you very much, Andy, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, apparently it's not only men who develop addictions to porn. Police in East Bethel, Minnesota have arrested 18-year-old Amanda Rose Owens after she admitted to investigators that she broke into a neighbor's home three times looking for items she could fence to feed her porn addiction. The neighbor actually called police claiming he had surveillance footage of young Miss Owens sneaking into his home through the dog door. He reportedly set up the camera after $300 and several items were stolen. Owens says she needed money so that she could pay for the 20 to 30 pornographic DVDs she bought. She's been charged with second-degree burglary. Wow. I wonder if Amanda is aware of the existence of the internet. I've been told you can probably find a fair amount of porn over the World Wide Web for free. Yeah. Okay, plenty of people love Superman, but 35-year-old Herbert Chavez of the Philippines loves Superman. So much so that he's having plastic surgery so he can look just like the Man of Steel. These surgeries actually started back in 1998. So far, he's had a chin augmentation to give him Superman's iconic cleft, rhinoplasty to transform his nose into one similar to actor Christopher Reeves, silicone injections into his lips to make them fuller, and thigh implants to make his legs appear more muscular. He has also had liposuction on his stomach and now plans more surgery on his abdomen to give him that Superman six-pack. Chavez says, "I have been a lifelong fan of Superman after being given a costume when I was a child. As I am only 5'6", yes, 5'6", and Superman is 6'2", I wouldn't rule out surgery to make me taller. As expected, with his obsession, Chavez is also the proud owner of a huge collection of Superman memorabilia, some of which is still in the original packaging in order to maintain its collector's values. His home is reportedly overflowing with life-size statues, action figures, clothing, comics, and posters of his hero. In other news, Herbert Chavez has never had a date, and probably never will. I saw a picture of him, actually, with his augmented face and the whole Superman thing. At 5'6", he looks like a muscular Michael Jackson in his latter years. That's not a good thing. Not a good thing at all. Former makeup artist Ruth Regina of Miami is carving out an unusual new career for herself as a wig maker for dogs. Her new collection of canine hair pieces is available on her website, wigglesdogwigs.com. And yes, there is a link from the stuff file to her website if you want to see. Don't laugh. People have been buying these things. Her bestseller is the Lady Gaga dog wig. Bob Marley and Sarah Palin hair pieces also do quite well. Ruth says, I never expected it to be so popular, but you can never underestimate how much people love dressing up their dogs. They're not cheap, by the way. Some wigs sell for upwards of $45, and the site's popularity is growing. Ruth added, I've been making dog wigs for friends for about 20 years, but I never charge for them. Then more and more requests came in, and eventually I decided to set up a separate business online. The website isn't very old, but we get a ton of requests from all over the world. Now, I've seen this lady on The Letterman Show. And you can go to her site, by the way, as I mentioned, wigglesdogwigs.com, and the link is at thestufffile.com. You can go to her site and see the link to her on The Letterman Show. Talk about a story that is simply wigged out. Anyway, moving along, in Ankara, Turkey, acting on a tip, police officers pulled over a large truck filled with bees and beehives that was reportedly being used to smuggle contraband. However, when the 15 officers went to search the vehicle, the alleged smugglers set swarms of bees free that attacked the officers and rendered them helpless. Ultimately, the truck was later searched by officers in beekeeping gear who seized some 32,500 packs of smuggled cigarettes. Since this is Turkey, the men were shot on sight. Actually, no, they weren't. Not really. But anyone who's seen the movie Midnight Express knows this can't be a good ending for these guys, no matter what their charges are. Can't be good. And by the way, you have to kind of admire their ingenuity, don't you? Yeah. Time for one more story before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Who could forget the iconic scene during the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq when soldiers pulled down the large bronze statue of then-dictator Saddam Hussein in Baghdad? Well, 52-year-old Nigel Spud Ely was working with media covering the fall of Baghdad at the time, and he said the soldiers gave him permission to remove Saddam's buttock from the fallen statue using a hammer and a crowbar. Now, that piece of history will be auctioned off in the UK. Hanson's Auctioneers, based in Derby in central England, will be handling the sale, which is expected to fetch in excess of $15,000. Wow, 15 grand for Hussein's bronze ass. Now, that's a cocktail party conversation starter for whomever buys it. Anyway, on to our first guest here on the Stuff File program. It's that time again. With us is Mark Abrams. He's here every year. He's with the Annals of Improbable Research, and they annually have the Ig Nobel Awards. Who are the big winners this year? Time to find out. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Peter. It's nice to be back.
Nice to have you on the program once again. Now, we've done this, as I've said, year after year after year, and the thing I find interesting is the press you are getting these days compares much differently from the press you got when you first started. Scientists and the press take your Ig Nobel Awards very seriously now.
Oh, seriously, I think, is not the word. It's just, I think, a different kind of respect that goes to this than goes to other things. It's, on important things like the Nobel Prizes, there's the obvious kind of respect. Somebody has done something that's clearly wonderful. You know, it makes the world a better place. With us, The Ig Nobels are for things that make people laugh and then think. You know, could be good, could be bad, doesn't matter. Could be important, could be completely unimportant, also doesn't matter. But the fact is that if somebody decides to accept a prize, they've not only done something that makes people laugh and then think, but they're willing to get up in public and talk about it and sort of celebrate the unusualness.
Well, let me put it this way then. You've definitely gone mainstream. You are to the Nobel Prizes what maybe the Razzies are to the Oscars. People look forward to both.
Well, it's nice to hear, I think.
So what are some of the interesting ones that came about this year?
Oh, they're all interesting. I'll tell you a few. There are 10 of them, as usual, and almost all of the winners came here to the big ceremony at Harvard in Massachusetts. At their own expense, they came. And we had, six Nobel Prize winners who were at the ceremony handing out the prizes to them. There was a team from several countries in Europe who won a prize in the field of physiology for a scientific study they published called No Evidence of Contagious Yawning in the Red-Footed Tortoise. And that's what they found. They looked very, very hard for some evidence that red-footed tortoises yawn after they see other red-footed tortoises yawn, and they found no evidence of this whatsoever.
Now can this data be extrapolated towards humans?
Well, that would just be pure guesswork, wouldn't it? The next step along the lines you are suggesting is for somebody to do an experiment.
Yes.
And I suppose that could be done in both directions, you know, two experiments. One is to see whether tortoises, red-footed tortoises, yawn after they see a human being yawning, and the other is to see whether a human being will yawn after seeing a red-footed tortoise yawn.
Mm-hmm. Now,
I'm not sure where I would place my money if I were forced to bet on it.
Okay.
You?
I'm not sure, but then again, I'm not a scientist, so hard to tell. One of the ones, and looking over the list, one of the ones that kind of caught me off guard and surprised me is your Peace Prize this year.
Huh. What did you find surprising about it?
That would be the mayor of Vilnius, right?
That's right. The mayor of Vilnius, Lithuania.
Who basically crushes parked cars, illegally parked cars, I may add, with a tank.
Yeah. He was trying to, this was done as a demonstration of what could and would be done if people didn't start behaving a little better about leaving their cars in the wrong places. And we have since been informed by an angry letter that clearly was written by a very happy U.S. Army member that the film that the mayor showed of him crushing a car did not, in fact, show him in an armored tank. It was an armored personnel carrier.
Of course. That makes all the difference.
Yeah, which has almost the same shape, but not quite.
Now, I understand the mayor actually showed up at the ceremony.
Yeah, the mayor, as I said, almost all of the winners came to the ceremony, and the mayor showed up, and he turned out to be extremely articulate. He was one of the big hits of the night. So he talked about what he did and why he did it, and showed a little video, and everybody was quite pleased to shake his hand.
See, again, the reason why I say it's kind of surprising is running over somebody's car with an armored personnel carrier doesn't sound very peaceful.
Well, most countries have armies, and at least if you ask them why they have an army, they might tell you it's because somebody might attack us, and we need the army so that we can remain peaceful. So I think in that same spirit, in the war against illegal parkers, this armored personnel carrier, although it might appear to be a weapon of war, could also be used as a weapon of peace.
Okay. I'll take that one. Now, you also had a public safety prize, and it was won by a rather elderly gentleman?
Yeah, it's the first time we've given, I think it is the first time we've given a prize in the field of public safety. It's won by John Senders, who's a professor emeritus at the University of Toronto. He's, I believe, 91 years old. This is for an experiment he did back in the mid-1960s. He got himself and other people to drive automobiles down a major highway, And while they were driving, the driver was wearing a special helmet that had a visor with a little machine that would make the visor repeatedly flap down over the driver's face, blinding the driver. They were trying to find out how much or how little attention do you really need to pay in order to drive a car safely.
Wow, and he did this in the 60s, you say?
Yeah, and there's film of this. If you go to our website, go to improbable.com, and you look at the list of winners, there's a link to the video. It's it really gets your attention.
So this guy was really ahead of his time. We're talking about a time when you didn't have to wear seat belts, didn't have reverse lights, and you didn't have a right-hand side rear-view mirror.
Right, and we may have had that. But he said that these days, what he found in those days also applies very directly to the question of should you be talking on a cell phone while you're driving a car, or should you be arguing with the kids in the back seat, or anything else. What he found really was that if you're doing anything that really draws some of your concentration, it's not going to help your driving.
Okay. One of the other ones that caught my eye, rather interesting, the psychology prize for this year.
Yeah, that went to a professor from University of Oslo, Norway, Carl Halvor Teigen. Professor Teigen won a prize for trying to understand why in everyday life people sigh.
And did he find out why?
I think he seemed to be saying that probably no one will ever completely understand, but he came to a better understanding probably than anyone ever has. He set up some difficult tasks for people. He'd give them, for example, some impossible puzzles to solve. And then he just watched them and note down if they sighed while they were doing this. And one of the strange things he found was afterwards, when he talked to people, a lot of them did not remember that they had just sighed. It was simply a part of what they did in frustrating situations.
I find what's very interesting in all of this is all of this, of course, is documented. All of these different studies are documented. And what your prize, I think, highlights is the fact that there is an entire world of very, very interesting studies going on out there that so many people aren't aware of. I'm assuming that with the Ig Nobel Prizes you award, this is just the tip of the iceberg to what is actually out there.
Oh, yeah. just to give you a little idea, the prizes go mostly to things in science, but as with the mayor of Vilnius and his parking solution, they go for almost anything else. But if we talk about just the world of science, and just the world of science where people will write a report and publish it in an official scientific journal so other scientists can see it, there are something like 25,000 science journals being published, you know, far more than anybody will see. There's just amazing, amazing amounts of stuff out there. And of course, we give prizes going back as far as 50 or 60 years also. So it's a gigantic amount of stuff.
That is absolutely amazing. And I think it says so much about the human brain, the human character, and what we as humans are interested in finding out about, not just simply questioning, but trying to find the answers.
Yeah, some of us are trying to hide the answers. pardon my laugh.
People can always find out more information, as you mentioned, and see video, and I believe streaming video too, if not of the actual award ceremony on your site.
Yeah, the whole ceremony was live on YouTube, and it's up there now. You can get a look at all these people. It's kind of wonderful.
And the website is www.improbable.com, right?
That's right. Or as we say south of the border, www.improbable.com.
Okay. I thank you very, very much once again, Mark, for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. Again, it was a pleasure.
Mark Abrams from the Annals of Improbable Research. They are the folks who put out the annual Ig Nobel Awards, and you can find out more information by going to their website at www.improbable.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0113, and you'll find the links.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for now and forever, unless the minds were right.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Know the Name, Know the Person, Letters Reveal Secrets as we discuss the intricacies behind names and nameology. Plus, we'll have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. And, of course, there is an idiot of the day. But right now, lots more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. In Fairview, Oregon, there's good news and bad news about teen delinquency. The good news is the teens aren't drinking anymore. The bad news is they've started chopping down trees in city parks instead. About a dozen trees have been chopped down at Fairview Woods Park, and police had been working on the case for about a month. They finally got a tip about teenagers spotted in the park with an axe. Ironically, all the city's units were currently busy working a standoff in nearby Troutdale, so Police Chief Ken Johnson jumped into action and handled the case himself. He left his desk and headed to the park with the school resource officer. Following the sounds of chopping, he found two teenagers with a hatchet in the act. When asked why they were doing this, the two teens replied, "It's better than drinking, and there's nothing better to do." But turns out, when it comes to criminal charges, chopping down city trees is not better than drinking. Chief Johnson says teen drinking would be a violation, but destroying city property is a felony. Not to mention that the teens have cost the city a lot of money, as much as $10,000 per tree. Wow. $10,000 per tree? What are you guys in Oregon planting out there anyway? $10,000 per tree? Anyway, moving right along, Chicago could become the first city in America to make it a crime to text while riding your bicycle. The proposal, recommended by the Pedestrian and Traffic Safety Committee, would also make it illegal to talk on a cell phone without a hands-free device while biking on the road. If approved by the city council, the ban will also go into effect sometime next month. The fine for a first offense would be $20 to $50. For a second offense, it would be $50 to $75, and for a third and subsequent offenses, it would be $75 to $100. If the offense came during a traffic accident, the fine could go as high as $500. Luann Hamilton, Deputy Commissioner of Project Development in the Chicago Department of Transportation, said, as bicyclists are road users with the same rights and duties as drivers, they should operate under the same restrictions. Cycling while texting. Wow. It's almost kind of sad that we would need a law for something that is clearly so egregiously idiotic to do in the first place, but there you go. Moving right along, they say hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, and they'd be right about 49-year-old Tony Joe Sylvie of Houston. Still fuming from the 2009 breakup with Houston leather artist Peter Main, Sylvie allegedly created an internet persona called Wounded Poetic Soul, and in June started a blog that detailed the breakdown of their relationship and her post-breakup bad behavior in excruciating detail. Now, this included calling Main names and posting rambling rants about his relationship with a younger woman. She also stands accused of egging his house several times and then posting pictures of herself bragging about it on Facebook. She allegedly shattered several of the windows of his West Houston home, first with a tire iron and then with a 5-foot sword, and called him 146 times within a 24-hour period. And she reportedly rammed her Chevy Blazer into his parked car, slamming it into the garage door and causing about $915 worth of damage. She was finally arrested and charged with felony stalking. Mr. Main told police officers he dated Sylvie briefly in 2009 and has been reluctant to file charges against her because he was afraid of angering her further. Well, that didn't work, did it? He also told police she called him 1,001 times and sent him 712 emails over the span of less than 3 months. Investigators found phone records detailing 146 calls in just one day back in August. Main told police he did not change his phone or email because he is self-employed and it would be detrimental to his business. In an interview with police, Sylvie repeatedly told the officer to read my blog, it's all there. And it turns out it was. I actually checked out her blog, and she's a wingnut. She gets the Glenn Close Award for Lunatic of the Decade, I think. Anyway, finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Joanna Snyder doesn't want you to hear this story. The 47-year-old repeat defendant told a Salem, Massachusetts Superior Court that news coverage of her many arrests and trials upsets her and her 19-year-old daughter. Newspaper stories have detailed charges of identity fraud, forgery, larceny, and drug dealing. One story had even noted a resemblance between her plea for leniency in 2010 and her plea for leniency in 2004. Every time she writes about me, she puts the whole thing in, she complained about the reporter. Snyder thus asked the judge to order the reporter not to write about her. I have no authority to control the press, said the judge, citing the First Amendment right to freedom of press. Replied Snyder, so if I took an article out on her, would that be fine? Yeah, perfect. Then she'd look stupid in the paper without a middleman. Yeah, you go, girl. Nice going, Joanna Snyder. Yeesh. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Celebrities have been known to give their children interesting names. Gwyneth Paltrow named her daughter Apple, and just this summer, Victoria and David Beckham named their baby girl Harper 7. But what's in a name? Sharon Lynn Wyeth is an educator and former school administrator. She has also developed Nameology, a science based on the placement of letters in a name, and she's the author of Know the Name, Know the Person, Letters Reveal Secrets. She joins us on the line right now from Texas. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program. Right off the bat, let's start with your name. For instance, seeing it on paper, people would say Sharon instead of Sharon. Besides a name, is there something in the way it's pronounced?
Yes, you take the interpretation of both what you hear and what you see. So with Sharon, it's the rose of Sharon in Israel, and it grows in higher places, so it allows Sharon, those people that call themselves Sharon, to have a higher vibration or have a deeper meditation, however you want to look at it.
So when did you develop and how did you develop Nameology?
I developed it over an 18-year time period. I started 30 years ago. And I did it because my brain is a math major and it's been trained in seeing patterns. And my brain started picking up patterns in people's names as I was a school teacher making seating charts. So when I had a bunch of unknown students at the beginning of the year, my brain started telling me about these children. And I was curious enough to write down what the brain said about all of it and then get to know the kids and look at it 3 months later. I was absolutely amazed. I mean, my Joshuas were brilliant and obnoxious. My Rachels were pretty. My Dianes could sit anywhere and get along with anybody. My Derricks needed extra time and attention. I mean, I was just amazed at what my brain had said about certain names. So then I went about doing it in a very logical, deductive, scientific method way, made lists of everybody I knew that had the same first name, and started writing down all the characteristics I had observed from those people, and started looking at where the comparisons were. And so I just kind of went crazy with lists on names and trying to figure out the patterns. It took me 15 years to work out all the nuances. Over that time period, I was invited to speak in 49 of our states. And afterwards, I got curious and said, I wonder if it works just as well in languages that aren't English but use our symbols. So in the next 3 years, I traveled over 70 countries, meeting people and giving speeches and doing research, and tested it, and it works just as well in other languages.
So are you saying then that we kind of live up to our names?
Well, we are our names, or our names are us, however you want to look at it. What the interesting part of that is that if you look at it from a scientific realm, there's a science called cymatics, C-Y-M-A-T-I-C-S. And in that science, they have done studies that show that sounds can literally change the cellular structure. So if we keep hearing our name over and over again, we're literally morphing into that cellular structure represented by our name. On the other hand, if you want to look at it from the religious point of view, when there was still only seven religions before they all multiplied, divided, and spread, they all agreed on numerous things. And one of the things that they agreed on was that the incoming soul impressed upon the person that was going to be naming them what they wanted to be called. So in essence, we name ourselves.
So what about people who, during the course of their life, either earlier or later, change their names?
Well, it's the same type of effect as if somebody takes on a nickname. And it depends on whether it's the first name or the last name that's being changed, because the first name is the essence of who the person is. The middle name is who they morph into or suddenly become when they're really under a lot of stress. So if they don't have a middle name, they stay the same as they always have been. And the last name represents our environment, or the push or the nurturing or what we're being taught by outsiders, how we're being influenced. So when we change our last name, we're saying we're changing our environment or what we're accepting from others. When we change our first name, we're saying we're trying not to show you the core of who we really are. Now we just want to show you this piece.
Now, what about people like myself who use all three names?
When you're using all three names, it means that you're trying to treat your middle name like your first name. So you stack the deck so you have more of you to work with on a regular daily basis.
Okay. Now, in the introduction, I mentioned the idea of celebrities and some of the names that they name their kids. And there's always this ongoing discussion that the names are weird or are odd. And for me, I've always found, while some names might be unusual, while some names I might not agree with, I think over time, a lot of names don't sound as odd in the long run as maybe when they were first envisioned. I go back to the name Wendy that everyone talks about, and no one ever heard of the name Wendy before Peter Pan.
Well, and now we've got a famous restaurant, fast food chain, called Wendy.
Exactly. There you go. So, when Gwyneth Paltrow named her daughter Apple, it might have sounded odd. Who knows? There might be hundreds or thousands of little girls named Apple 20 years from now.
Well, and as long as they're not fruity, it's okay. When I look at the name Apple, actually, and I dissect the different letters and their placement, it means somebody who's going to have a lot of influence, who's going to be like a Pied Piper. People are just going to want to follow her. She's going to have a tendency to be a workaholic, but she's going to want to play at her work and work at her plate. Her work is play, and play will be work. She's going to be very generous with her time, almost to a fault. And the older she gets, the more self-confident she gets. So it's not a bad name when you're looking at it.
So should people take this seriously when naming their child, or should, sometimes you have people who name their children long before they're born. Some parents wait to see the child before they name. a baby, does it really make a difference?
Every name has positives and every name has challenges. So to me, it really doesn't make a difference. It's when you get that impulse of what your child should be named, I say go with it. I may tweak the spelling a little bit, knowing namology, from how that the original name might be spelled. But everything's going to have positives and everything's going to have challenges. For an example, suppose the first name of the child has an ER combination. The E has to come first, followed by the R. That means that they're going to get into sexuality early. They're going to be really curious about it. And so if you have that in your child's name, you're going to want to teach about the birds and the bees at a very young age, probably prior to third grade.
Wow. Okay, so what about a name like mine? Mine's very common, Peter.
Well, it's got that ER, so it means that you're tactile, that you like to touch, that you like the texture of things. The first vowel is an E, so that means you're a detective. You like to get to the bottom of things. You like to know what makes people tick. You like to dwell into things so there's no mystery there anymore. You like to solve those puzzles in life. The P in the front says that you are very playful in a way, and you are very influential, that you carry, your words carry a lot of influence or a lot of weight when other people hear them. The T in the middle of your name says that you have good athletic hand-eye coordination. It would come out in sports where you would be very athletic or easier for you to pick up things like the hand-eye coordination with balls or running or whatever. And so the R at the end would say that you're a little bit rebellious. You don't like to be told what to do. You like to be asked. You don't want to be told no. When somebody tells you no, you want to say, oh, yeah, just watch me. And that you have a real thing for the truth. You don't like it when people are dishonest with you, and you don't want to give them a second chance. So those are some of the things that come out named Peter. I mean, I can talk on a name for over an hour, so I'm just pulling some of them out.
Okay, do you have children?
Yes, I do.
So how did you go about naming your kids, knowing what you know? Was that an easier choice, a difficult choice, more difficult choice? What?
Well, actually, I had both my kids before I'd figured out namology, and I laughed today saying it was a good thing because they probably wouldn't have gotten the name that they wanted had I known namology at the time. The children, my son's name starts with a J, and for all parents of boys whose names start with a J, it means that the child listens to you, and then they do what they want to do anyway. And so they're some of the most challenging kids to rear, but as they get into adulthood, they're fabulous because they're brilliant. My daughter's name starts with a C, and then has an O next to it. So, and C's are charming and charismatic to cover up their need to be in charge and in control. And out of all the vowels, the O likes to be the boss the most. So you put the control person right next to the boss, and those people really want to have things their own way.
This is fascinating stuff. Now, I understand there's a website, bestnamemeanings.com. Is that correct?
Yes. That's one if somebody wants to just go play with names and find out some information about names.
Excellent. And as for the book itself, people can get the book. The book is called, again, Know the Name, Know the Person, Letters Reveal Secrets. People can go to knowthename.com.
Yes, and they can order the book there, which is a little bit cheaper. It saves them some money than if they ordered on Amazon, but it's also available in many stores.
And how's the book doing? I mean, since you've come up with this, like I said, a very interesting concept. It's more food for thought for people, especially if they want, not only if they want to know what their own name means, but if they're in the process of naming a child.
Well, and even if you're going to hire somebody, or you're going to date somebody. I mean, there's all kinds of hidden things in that name that'll let you know a little bit more about the person. And the book, as of July, has been an Amazon bestseller, so I'm very pleased with it.
And again, going back to the what I said in the introduction, do you find some of the celebrity names odd? I mentioned Victoria and David Beckham's baby girl, Harper 7.
Well, I look at that one and I think, you know, when it plays all out, it doesn't become odd because it gives her a lot of gifts and it gives her a lot of help, and it's a lot of balance between physicality and mental. So it's saying, I want you to be smart enough to coordinate your body and be a good sports person. And if you look at the parents, you know, they're into the physical appearance and being in good shape. So it's a perfect name for a child. I mean, but there's been some what we might call strange names that now we don't think anything about, like Kiefer Sutherland.
Right.
You know, that's a very different first name. And in fact, he has multiple names. His name is really long. He's one of the people I talk about in my book.
And that book is Know the Name, Know the Person, Letters Reveal Secrets. It's written by Sharon Lynn Wyeth. And Sharon, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Peter, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sharon Lynn Wyeth, author of Know the Name, Know the Person, Letters Reveal Secrets. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0113, and you'll find links to Sharon's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You can also check out her weekly column called What's in a Name at www.boomer-living.com. That's www.boomer-living.com. A link to that is also on the Stuff File website. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Wouldn't it be nice if there were a simple way to get rid of all the frivolous lawsuits we hear about in the news? For example, when a blind man is sued after accidentally stepping on someone's foot, and yes, that was a real lawsuit, shouldn't there be an easy way for a judge to throw that case out? Believe it or not, there is a way. The lawyer representing a victim of a frivolous lawsuit simply has to ask the judge to dismiss it. Whether the judge does that is another matter, but the point is, judges must be asked first. Let's be fair. You'd think that every lawyer who's hired to defend someone from a frivolous lawsuit would do that. But not so. Several judges have told me over the years that too many lawyers simply don't ask them to dismiss frivolous lawsuits. Now, I don't want to step on anyone's toes here, but if someone ever files a frivolous case against you, make sure your lawyer's first move is to have that case dismissed. Find out more. Go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And Stuart's here with Book Banter. Hi, Stu.
Hey, Peter, got a question for you.
What's that?
What were you doing around this time, around 1979?
1979. I was working at FM 96.
Yeah.
Being part of the morning show. That's many, many years ago.
Oh, yes.
And I was also finishing up at Dawson College.
Oh, you were? Oh, so you're doing a little bit of, on-the-job training, I guess.
Yes.
Ah, pretty good. Well, around that time, I was about 16 going on 17, there was two shows. There were two shows that me and my friends always watched religiously every week. Saturday Night Live on NBC, that was like the original Not Ready for Primetime Players, and Sneak Previews on PBS. We like to watch Sneak Previews not only because we got the chance to preview the latest film releases, but saw how two American newspaper film critics, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, would be there and colorfully discuss and sometimes argue about why they like or dislike the movie in question. And somehow the two of them made something that looked mundane on the surface, and it looked so quite entertaining, you know what I mean? But for more than 30 years, I've had the greatest respect for Roger Ebert as one of the foremost movie critics and film authorities around, and the eloquent way he expressed himself about why he liked or disliked a certain movie, whether it be on TV with his show Sneak Previews and then at the movies, or in his columns for the Chicago Sun-Times, which earned him a Pulitzer Prize in 1975, or his 17 books, including his annual movie yearbooks. And even though his voice has literally been silenced due to a successful yet devastating battle with thyroid cancer that cost him most of his lower jaw in 2006, his insightful, intelligent look at movies and the people who make them possible have continued even more than ever thanks to his Sun-Times column, his own website and blog, which gets about 110 million visitors a year. That's a lot of visitors. And his new PBS series, Ebert Presents at the Movies. And now, the crazy quilt that is Roger Ebert's personal and professional life has now been revealed to the public in a grand scale in his 18th and most personal book, his fabulous memoir called Life Itself. Now, when you read Life Itself, you easily discover that Ebert's life is one big movie that contains plenty of comedy and drama, with each aspect of that life played out in different scenes. And whether his early childhood in the university town of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, that's home of the University of Illinois, the Illini, where his early days in journalism, which started off as the editor of the Daily Illini, and also as a cub reporter for the local Champaign-Urbana News Gazette, And then when he went to the Chicago Sun-Times in 1966, he rubbed shoulders with some of the greatest names in Chicago print journalism, like Mike Royko and Studs Terkel. And barely a year after joining the paper, he was named the Sun-Times film critic, and he never looked back. In his book, he gives a detailed and entertaining look at how the movies have been good to him for all these years, from his countless trips to the Cannes Film Festival to his encounters with such legendary actors as Lee Marvin, Robert Mitchum, and John Wayne, and directors like Martin Scorsese, Woody Allen, and Ingmar Bergman. We even get to find out what it was like for Ebert to be the screenwriter for Russ Meyer's cult classic 1970s sexploitation flick Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
I find it very interesting that he brings that up in the book, because I'm thinking that's one of the things in his life he'd probably like to forget.
No, actually, he devotes a good chunk of the book, the early part of the book, to his working with Russ Meyer and working on the script for that movie that I least likely suspect that Ebert would do such a thing. And of course, what would that book be complete with without writing about his love-hate relationship with late Gene Siskel that lasted nearly 25 years and was filled with a lot of humor and strong opinions? You get the feeling that Ebert still deeply misses his old friend and colleague, and fellow film reviewer, in which they helped each other become national celebrities just for sitting around and talking about movies. Also, for the first time, Ebert gives us an intimate look at the ordeal that was the most difficult period of his life, his battle with thyroid cancer and the three unsuccessful surgical attempts to reconstruct his face. As a result, it cost him not only his lower jaw, but his ability to talk, eat, and drink. Now, Ebert has remained quite philosophical about this near-death experience and has accepted his fate with a positive approach, which would not have been possible without the tireless love and support of his wife, Chaz. And, you know, when you read this book, you really think what a saint Chaz really is. God bless her, I'll tell you that. But Life Itself is a book that gives us the complete, definitive picture of Roger Ebert, the man, the film critic. And for living such a charmed life, doing a job that he enjoyed and still enjoys doing to this day, for being able to indulge in his passions, for being able to survive a terrifying medical ordeal and move forward more verve and enthusiasm despite the physical limitations that it presents, and being able to express it so eloquently and compellingly in this book, Roger Ebert, in my book, certainly deserved 2 thumbs up.
And the book is?
It's called Life Itself by Roger Ebert. And if you like movie book reviews, just check Leonard Maltin's annual film review guides. Roger Ebert's The Great Movies, Volumes 1, 2, and 3, and also The Pioneer, the book that started it all with Leonard Maltin and Roger Ebert, Stephen Schuer's Movies on TV, if you can find a copy of it.
And Roger's book is published by?
Grand Central Publishing, and it's $29.99.
Excellent, sir. Thank you once again for being on the Stuff File program.
Oh, my pleasure, Peter. Anytime, and you get 2 thumbs up with me, too.
You too, pal. You too. Stuart Nauman with Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And on the Stuff File program, we have a few more Stuff File news stories to get to before we wrap things up with, of course, the idiot of the day. A female Wisconsin prison chaplain was charged in September with several crimes in an alleged attempt to stage a fake hostage situation with an inmate for the purpose of gaining transfers of both to another prison in the state. Prosecutors said the chaplain, a Wiccan priest named Jamie Witch, and Witch is spelled W-I-T-C-H, I don't make this up, I can't, she's 52 by the way, instructed the inmate at Oshkosh Correctional Institution to come to her office, barricade the door, throw things around the room, and role play with Witch as if she was his mother. While the office was under siege, the pair allegedly had consensual sex, and Witch supplied the man with drugs and sang him lullabies, supposedly to calm him down, ending the drama until charges were filed. Okay, did someone have to sign off on a Wiccan priest as a prison chaplain? Methinks some sort of explanation might be required here. That's just a little too bizarre. Anyway, moving right along, a Swedish court has ruled that the staff at a prison had no right to interrupt an inmate and his girlfriend while they were having sex during an authorized visit simply because the couple's 5-month-old daughter was in the room at the time. The incident took place at a prison in eastern Sweden, prompting the inmate's fiancé to file a complaint arguing that staff members at the prison behaved inappropriately when they barged in on the couple having sex. The fiancé had brought along the couple's infant daughter for the scheduled Saturday visit. After a few minutes of playing with their child, the couple fed her and put her to sleep in a stroller. If it makes you feel any better, it was only after the baby had fallen asleep that the couple hopped into the adjacent bed and got busy. Anyway, suddenly there was a knock on the door, at which point two male guards entered the room while the couple lay naked between the sheets. The guards chastised the inmate, claiming that, quote, it was a crime against social service laws to have naked sexual relations in a room when a child is present. Not only did the judge in the case express doubts over the merits of the general ban on sex in the presence of a child, but she also argued that the guards could have explained the policy to the couple before they entered the room. Okay, what I would like to know is, how did the guards know they were having sex? Is there a camera in that room that nobody is aware of? I'm just asking. Anyway, under the headline of Least Competent Criminals, Anthony Watson, sentenced to prison in 1992 for crimes that included rape and robbery, became a notorious jailhouse lawyer, even drafting a book entitled A Guide to the Plea Circus, and through successful challenges had reduced his 160-year sentence to only 26, and a release date of 2018. He had 160 years on a sentence, and he got it reduced to 26. That's some good jailhouse lawyering, if you ask me. However, he filed one appeal too many. A court ruled in his favor on that final appeal and ordered a new trial altogether, which vacates the convictions and therefore the sentence and also the reductions Watson had worked so hard for. At the retrial in March of this year, he was found guilty again, and this time sentenced to 4 consecutive life terms. Be careful what you wish for, pal. Nice going, jumping the shark there with that one. Nice going indeed. Almost the idiot of the day, but again, he's too smart for the idiot of the day. Too smart for his own good in this case. Moving right along, we get to the idiot, by the way, in a matter of moments. Police in Hampshire, England, found what has to be the world's most distracted driver. Our friend was caught driving while using a laptop, writing down the answers to a radio quiz, and drinking coffee all at the same time. Rather insane, if you ask me, especially considering Hampshire police are conducting a very publicized campaign to crack down on distracted drivers. Sergeant Paul Diamond said, "This should send a very loud message out to all those motorists out there who are doing roughly the same thing." Yeah, it would in a perfect world, but it's too bad they're not hearing any of this because they're, well, you know, distracted. As promised, by the way, right now we have for your listening pleasure our final story. That would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
After allegedly robbing a Wells Fargo bank branch in Yuma, Arizona, police say 56-year-old Henry Elmer then went to a nearby restaurant and spent some of the stolen loot on pizza and beer. As if that weren't dumb enough, we might mention that the bank branch he allegedly robbed just happened to be located right across the street from the Yuma police station. Elmer reportedly entered the bank, produced a box cutter knife, and fled with an undisclosed amount of cash. Police caught up with him at the restaurant before his pizza and beer had even been served. Why would you rob a bank across the street from a police station and then just stroll to a nearby pizza joint for a bite and a beer? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0113. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And if you go to the website, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And again, that's 0113. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise to buy, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.